Palestinians condemn as provocative Israel's plan for the construction of hundreds of new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Saudi warplanes launched fresh airstrikes in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, leaving several casualties and material damage. And Solomon Islands police say that they have found three bodies in a burnt-out building following days of violent protests in the capital, Honiara. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian Authority has condemned Israel for approving the construction of 372 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says that the plan is provocative and is an extension of the Israeli process of expanding settlements in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. The new project includes homes, commercial buildings, and educational institutions. Israel has built thousands of settlements on occupied Palestinian land over the past years as part of its land grab policy. All Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Earlier, we talked to Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab to get his thoughts on the issue. He says that Israel's continued settlement activities in the occupied West Bank are a slap in the face of the international community.
And one of the last decisions done by the United Nations Security Council during the Obama-Biden administration was Resolution 2334, which made it illegal to build and to expand and continue building illegal settlements in the West Bank. The idea that settlements continue at a time when the Israeli government is publicly saying we don't want to have negotiations, there's not going to be any solution to the conflict, is a slap in the face of the international community.
The Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have expressed their anger at the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs' visit to Morocco. They describe the visit as a stab in the back of Palestinians. Ruba Shabit has more from the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip expressed their anger at the security pact signed between Israel and Morocco, describing it a betrayal that eroded their leverage with Israel. The agreement is part of the first official visit by Benny Gantz to one of the Arab states that normalized ties with the regime last year, provoking wide outrage among Palestinians.
This is a stab in the back of our Palestinian cause and the Arab and Islamic nations. This visit of Benny Gantz to Morocco gives Israel a green light to go further with the new crimes. All Palestinian factions refuse this move and totally condemn normalizing ties with Israel. We stress that no ties can give Israel any right in our lands, as it will remain our enemy.
Palestinians say governments that have normalized ties with Israel do not represent their people.
This is really disappointing. Welcoming Benny Gantz in Morocco is a betrayal for Palestinians. He killed our children and launched conflicts in Gaza. Instead of welcoming him in Arab countries, he should have been held accountable for his crimes and delivered a punishment for killing our people. We call on Moroccan people to voice louder to end the ties with Israeli regime.
Meanwhile, Moroccans took to the streets in front of the parliament building in Rabat, condemning Gantz's visit to Morocco. The demonstration was suppressed by the police.
Our brothers and sisters in Morocco always support us. We don't blame the people for what their government is doing. We call on Moroccan people to protest against these ties that mainly aim at silencing Palestinians' voice and giving Israel a permission to commit more and more of crimes in the region. All Arab and Islamic nations should stand against the normalization of ties with Israel and support Palestinians in their struggle.
Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan signed agreements to normalize relations with Israel in 2020 as part of the so-called Abraham Accords, which were brokered by administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The recent visit of Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, to Morocco has angered Palestinians. They consider ties between Israel and Morocco as a green light to the Israeli regime to press ahead with its crimes in the region. Palestinians call on Arab nations to stop their governments from normalizing ties with Israel, calling it a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Saudi-led coalition has carried out fresh airstrikes in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washadi says that there has been an unknown number of casualties as well as material damage.
Saudi Arabia has been escalating its attacks on civilians on the residential areas in the capital city in Sana'a. They are pushing the Yemeni army to keep pressing ahead, to keep attacking the Saudi facilities. The Saudi warplanes have launched yesterday two airstrikes on Al-Nahdain area. They have been almost launching airstrikes every day during the past months, and this will absolutely push the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks. It is the right of the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks, as Yemenis are depending on the army to push and to force the kingdom to stop these attacks against civilians. Most of the casualties of these attacks are only children and women. They are killing the Yemeni people for the seventh year. So I believe that the Yemeni army will be responding in the few coming days to the Saudi attacks and will be pushing the Saudi regime to stop its attacks on civilians.
The Solomon Islands police have found three bodies in a burned-out building following rioting in the capital, Honiara, in the past several days. Media reports say the charred bodies have been discovered in a store in the Chinatown district. The cause of the deaths remains unclear, as forensic teams launched an investigation into the incident. Buildings in the Chinatown neighborhood have been looted and burnt during the unrest. More than 100 people have been arrested for rioting and looting linked to the recent anti-government protests. A host of domestic issues, including failed development promises, are said to have triggered the riot. The demonstrators want Prime Minister Manase Sugawara to step down. Japan is planning to boost its military might. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida says that he is seeking to create a strong self-defense force to protect the country against foreign threats.
I've made instructions to revise the National Security Strategy, National Defense Program Guidelines, and Medium-Term Defense Program Plans. Among them, we will consider all options, including possessing the capability to attack so-called enemy bases to strengthen our defense power that is necessary.
Kishida was speaking at an annual ceremony in the capital, Tokyo, reviewing the country's armed forces. Kishida has expressed concern about North Korea's ballistic missile tests. He's also referred to mounting tensions with China and its military buildup in the region. The Japanese government has recently approved plans to add over $6 billion to its annual military spending. Tokyo says the move aims to bolster the country's air and maritime defensive capabilities. South Korean presidential contender Lee Jae-myung argues that the U.S. policies of sanctions have failed, indicating that under his leadership, Seoul would take a much more independent line in relations with North Korea. Lee is running neck and neck with conservative Yoon Suk-yeol in the election set for March 9th. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
South Korean presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, Liberal Lee Jae-myung, met with the foreign media in Seoul this week. He wasted little time in suggesting, if elected, his office would seek greater independence from U.S. influence.
In the perspective of the United States that stands far away, the issues of the Korean Peninsula are only one part of the country's military and security strategies. But for the 80 million Koreans who live on the peninsula, such issues are related to their future and lives.
The U.S. has been pressuring South Korea to maintain sanctions on North Korea over Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs. At the same time, Washington has so far avoided current President Moon Jae-in's proposal to officially declare an end to the 1950-53 Korean War. Despite the U.S. hard line, Lee appears likely to seek much more amicable relations with North Korea.
Assessing only the current situations, I believe that the current soft line policy is more effective in dealing with North Korea than a hard line policy or sanctions.
Regarding this presidential election, some experts believe the U.S.-South Korea alliance hangs in the balance.
Lee Jae-myung obviously wants to reconcile with North Korea, and he's willing to give up sanctions and possibly even call an end to joint military exercises. The U.S. entire relationship a military relationship with South Korea would, some people think, be at stake if Mr. Lee is elected.
Running neck and neck with Lee is conservative Yoon Suk-yeol, who suggested to deploy nuclear weapons in South Korea to deter the threat posed by Pyongyang.
That for security on the United States, and yet China's South Korea's largest trading partner. For whoever assumes the presidency here next to spring, navigating the competing interests in Washington and Beijing will prove a serious challenge. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thousands of people have marched across Australia's east coast to protest against mandatory coronavirus vaccinations. Protesters again gathered in front of the Victorian Parliament in Melbourne, as well as in Hyde Park in Sydney and at beaches in Brisbane. The anti-vaccination rallies have continued for weeks in Australia, becoming occasionally violent. The anti-vaccination movement, however, remains small, with polls showing nationwide opposition in the single digits. While nationwide vaccinations are voluntary, states and territories have mandated vaccinations for many occupations and have barred the unvaccinated activities like dining out and concerts. Well, concerns are growing about a new variant of coronavirus first detected in southern Africa. Countries around the world are now restricting travel from some African nations to prevent the arrival of the strain called Omicron. Australia plans to ban people who have been to 9 South African countries, including South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. Authorities say that Australian citizens and their dependents departing from those countries are allowed to enter, but are required to quarantine for 2 weeks. Separately, the U.S. says that it will bar entry to most travelers from 8 southern African countries. The decision will come into force on Monday. The World Health Organization has voiced concern over the new COVID strain, which is believed to be a lot more transmissible.
So Omicron B.1.1.529 is named as a variant of concern because it has some concerning properties. This variant has a large number of mutations, and some of these mutations have some worrying characteristics. Right now, there are many studies that are underway. There's a lot of work that is ongoing in South Africa and in other countries to better characterize the variant itself in terms of transmissibility, in terms of severity, and any impact on our countermeasures like the use of diagnostics, therapeutics, or vaccines.
The official says the UN Health Agency is closely monitoring the new variant. She has called for adherence to social distancing and wearing masks to minimize possible exposure to the virus as scientists study its severity. The European Union's Health Organization has also warned that the new strain could pose a very high level of risk to the bloc. Infectious diseases specialist Gloria Taliani says the new COVID variant has raised concerns around the world due to properties that make it highly contagious.
The variant of concern are observed very closely by WHO and other countries because they may represent really a danger for spreading of the virus and infecting many peoples without having has any real effective tool to contrast it. The reasons are mainly based on the mutations that are observed in the sequence of the virus that confer resistance to the presently employed vaccines. But the other characteristic that we are not really convinced of about this variant is the capability of spreading very efficiently all over the world. And in this case, the combination of the two characteristics would confer to the virus, to the new variant, a very dangerous characteristic itself, and will determine an alarm that really sets people being concerned.
Amid politically charged times, relations between Paris, London, and Brussels have become extremely strained. Mass drownings of refugees, fishing rights, and Brexit are all contributing to an ever-widening diplomatic rift. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Relations between France and the United Kingdom are reaching tragic new lows in the English Channel. British cargo vessels were blocked from docking in French ports, the latest escalation in what should be a minor economic dispute over fishing rights. French fishermen say their livelihoods are being manipulated by Paris and Brussels in order to deter another Brexit.
We really cannot go on like this. We have the feeling that we are being used as pawns and that we fishermen are the only ones impacted by this situation. We must send a signal to the Spanish government that we cannot stay in this posture of waiting instead of acting.
Another surprising row has erupted following the recent drowning of some 30 refugees off the coast of Calais, the deadliest such accident ever recorded. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted a diplomatic request calling for joint Franco-UK maritime patrols and also new immigration agreements with both France and the European Union. Paris didn't only reject these suggestions, they disinvited the UK to emergency talks on preventing more drownings as refugees continue to set sail for England.
I am surprised at Johnson's method of communication, which is so unserious. Leaders of nations should not communicate with each other by tweets or public letters. We should work seriously on serious questions with serious people. We will work with the United Kingdom when they decide to be serious.
Many are saying that Macron's form over function complaint over Johnson's tweet reveals that he's trying to politicize English Channel crises for election-related gains. Two far-right candidates are threatening to run away with April's presidential election largely on immigration-related issues. Macron continues to retain a hardcore base of support of around 20% of voters. While that may be enough to put him into the second round, many wonder if he will become the nation's third consecutive one-term president. As post-Brexit Europe settles into hardened reality, issues both minor and major may become over-politicized with increasing regularity. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Now, from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide. It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fallen victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was and that there was just death and destruction, and that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see in here and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place. Have any bottled water before we get going, just in case.
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps. And he fought in Vietnam.
My parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18 and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married. And 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so violent and all that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it because they scared the bottom of me because I was just a kid.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family, and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn.
It don't last for long.
two miscarriages. She lost two children. And no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect, so it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, my mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at a very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely was pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom, and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator. And they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was going to live or die or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my leg, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before. Like, one of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back, and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I love school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn, and I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay, because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different, that's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different, because I was always going to the doctors, and I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me. Or
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included,
could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever has?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff from being like in the hospitals and stuff all the time, and some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities are so much alike. There's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year round. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting.
So my father says that he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I've found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 planes.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chu Lai Air Base, and while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on the clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange.
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliant he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
My dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it and he would have to load it into the tanks, and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble, and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death, utero and growth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed, among the exposed, than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies and now very sure, certain that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny.
Yes. Yeah.
Cannot deny.
The biggest child
of the family is a normal child because he was born before the time that the dad came to the army.
Do you know in America who carries the pennant of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible. Our fathers felt responsible. Even for in Vietnam, I mean, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decision.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. Came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues, and he was getting weak, and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.
Thank you.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bag 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to your program For a Better Life. I'm Javed Akbari, and in this session we are going to speak about morality in life. Of course, Islam praises and lauds good manners very strongly and very clearly. Of course, it is important to understand why good manners is strongly lauded by Islam. Having good manners transcends a lot more than just a few words, but it is a strong foundation for those who wish to build good character as they grow older. The virtues of good manners are seen in various ahadiths and various sayings which have been transmitted by generations of scholars to us And these traditions are these sayings of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and those of his noble successors point to good character that is pleasing to God and his messenger. The Holy Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, has reminded us that the most beloved of Allah's servants to Allah are those with the best manners. Of course, this is a famous hadith which has been reported in both Shia and Sunni sources. Now, this quite well indicates that morality is the best thing a person can have. It exceeds in terms of value, in terms of superiority, any other thing in life. Now, having good manners when socializing with other people, when interacting with other people, isn't just an important factor. Of course, when dealing with people in this temporary abode, it's not the only important factor, but even more so, it is part and parcel of pleasing God in His majesty. If you want to please Allah, you have to be a man or a woman of good character. So, because that is the thing that counts a lot, that is highly significant. We need to develop good habits in our life, and we need to make conscious and deliberate efforts to create good habits and to develop good manners in our life. Good habits are formed by continual repetition of certain acts which actually lead to certain disposition. And man is a free agent. He is able to change his life by making conscious efforts or by putting himself in an environment which shapes his character and his personality. Let's have a short break, dear brothers and sisters.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man cannot escape the influence of the environment, whether that environment is positive or whether it is destructive. It does not matter. It will have an impact on your individual, on your personality, and on your life, whether you want it or not. But what is actually important is that we need to develop good habits in our life, because there is a saying from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who said, "Ma yudha'u fi mizani imra'in yawm al-qiyamati afdalu min husn al-khulq." Nothing is weightier, nothing is heavier on the scale of deeds than one's good manners. So good manners are so important, and good manners therefore are an important realm in building a character of a true Muslim, one who continuously wishes to follow the Holy Prophet of Islam for the sake of God, one who wishes to emulate Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, for the sake of Allah. Now, Islam indeed prioritizes akhlaq above all aspects of life. As I said, akhlaq is such a thing that without which a person who is in fact a social being cannot live in the society without proper akhlaq, good habits. It is almost impossible for an individual to live a life of dignity, to associate with other people, to interact with other people. You know, man as a social being, he has to interact with other people. He has to have a give and take relationship with other people. So the concept of akhlaq actually centers around the faith of oneness of Allah. Spiritual values need to first be inculcated in oneself in order for those values to be rendered into practice to achieve the height of human development. Now, the height of human development is something that is no limit to it, and there's no limit to being good. There's no restriction whatsoever to being a perfect individual. Perfection is something that is not achieved overnight. It is achieved with the passage of time. The Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, was well-mannered in his speech and his manners And of course, there are different reports, there are different traditions and hadiths that have been reported and transmitted from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. The Prophet of Islam was the best role model in everybody's life, and he is the best role model, because the hadith from the Prophet, peace be upon him, says that innama bu'ithtu li utammima makarim al-akhlaq. Of course, I have been commissioned and I have been sent forth to perfect the morals. Now, the Prophet of Islam was never obscene, never coarse. Rather, he used to tell us that he was the best among us, and he was the best among those with the best manners, of course. He was the most perfect role model.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Even amongst the youth, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family was very respectful. He never spoke down to the youngsters around him, even if they asked a lot of questions or made mistakes, like many youngsters often do. Instead, he would treat them like adults, appreciate their hard work and ideas, and gently advise if he felt advice was needed. He would give his advice whenever it was necessary. Now, there is a reporter. The reporter's name is Anas ibn Malik, and of course, he is a well-known reporter. He has reported that he said, "I served the Prophet of Allah for 10 years. During that time, he never once said to me, as much as oof, if I did something wrong. He never asked me if I had failed to do something. He never asked me if I had failed to do something. Why did you not do it? Or why did you do that? And he never said to me if I had done something wrong. Why did you do it?" We obviously understand the importance of good manners, and it's not always easy, especially when having to deal with all sorts of people in today's world, to maintain good manners, but it is possible. It's not impossible. Good manners obviously encompass a wide range of social etiquette, from speaking to groups of people, and from speaking in public to avoiding backbiting or fault finding, to speak pleasantly to others, but to avoid, excessive flattery, and so on and so forth. These are all included in good manners. Of course, since we are running out of time, I would suffice with this hadith from the Holy Prophet. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud reported that the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, and his family said, "If they are three people, two of them should not carry on a conversation from which the third is excluded. For surely that will be distressing to him, because if one person is left out and two persons are speaking among themselves, then that person who is excluded will feel hurt." So inshallah, we will continue our discussion in the following episode. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.